KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. The top U.S. and Russian diplomats meet in Saudi Arabia, marking the upending of U.S. foreign policy that sought to isolate Moscow. We'll have more on what that might mean for Ukraine and beyond ahead on Morning Edition from NPR News. The Trump administration has started to make broad cuts across federal health agencies. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Our health correspondent, Ping Wong, tells us about what workers got termination letters over the weekend. Also, four of New York City Mayor Eric Adams' closest aides say they're quitting. And we hear from a man whose business is on hold after the Trump administration puts out a blanket freeze on government grants. It's Tuesday, February 18th. I bet actor John Travolta is celebrating staying alive today. He turned 71. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Kuhlman. Secretary of State Marco Rubio has concluded a day of discussion with his Russian counterpart. The teams talked about moving toward a peace agreement for Ukraine. But Ukraine was not invited to the talks. Neither were European officials. Rubio says there will have to be concessions to end the war in Ukraine. Trump administration officials have previously said Ukraine cannot get back all the territory that Russia invaded and that Ukraine cannot join NATO. These are both key Russian demands the Trump administration is agreeing to. Maryland Democratic Senator Chris Van Hollen says Ukraine has also rejected President Trump's demand for much of Ukraine's key minerals.
Can you imagine FDR in the middle of World War II saying to Churchill, you know, we're not going to continue to help you until you turn over half of your coal and mineral reserves? That's not how you behave when you want to support a friend who's under attack by an authoritarian like Putin.
He spoke to CNN. Hamas in Gaza says it will hand over the bodies of four Israeli hostages on Thursday and six living hostages on Saturday. Israel had asked Hamas to speed up the hostage releases. NPR's Daniel Estrin has more from Tel Aviv.
Hamas says on Thursday it will give Israel the bodies of four hostages, including those of the Bibas family. Shiri Bibas and her two young children, aged four and nearly one when they were captured, have long been feared dead. On Saturday, Hamas says it will release all six living hostages it had committed to freeing by the end of February, including two hostages held in Gaza for about a decade. Next week, Hamas is expected to give Israel four more hostages' bodies. After that, 59 hostages will remain in Gaza, nearly half of them confirmed dead. In return, Israel says it's allowing mobile homes into Gaza for those whose homes were destroyed, plus heavy machinery to retrieve bodies buried under rubble. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Stocks opened lower this morning after the long holiday weekend. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average slipped about 130 points in early trading.
Investors in Constellation Brands may be raising a glass after news Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway has taken a stake in the company. Constellation sells spirits, wine, and beer, including Mexican imports Corona and Modelo. Its shares had taken a beating on President Trump's threats of new import tariffs, so Buffett may have gotten a bargain. Southwest Airlines is cutting its corporate workforce, shedding more than 1,700 workers, including 15% of its senior management committee. It's the airline's first major layoff in more than half a century of operation. Southwest says in a statement it's trying to become a leaner, more agile organization. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow is now down about 125 points. This is NPR. The Energy Department has reversed the firings of many workers that it just sacked. The workers are responsible for overseeing the nation's nuclear weapons. Some employees say they were rehired within hours of being let go. Some members of Congress expressed alarm about mass layoffs at an agency that guards U.S. nuclear warheads and fights nuclear terrorism. A winter storm warning blankets much of Kentucky today, a few days after powerful storms raked the south. At least a dozen people died in Kentucky. One person was killed in West Virginia, and another person perished in Georgia. Mexican singer Paquita La Del Barrio has died at the age of 77. As NPR's Isabella Gomez Sarmiento reports, the singer was known as a voice of heartbreak and rage.
Paquita La Del Barrio, which informally translates to Paquita from the block, became a star in Mexico in the 1980s. She was beloved for the disdain with which she sang about the men who broke her heart. Rata de dos patas. Paquita said her music was inspired by her real relationships. For decades, her lyrics channeled her pain into feminist rage. In the hit Una Rata de Dos Patas, she famously compared an ex-lover to a cursed leech and a poisonous snake. Paquita La del Barrio's team announced her passing. No cause of death was given. Mexico City's Department of Culture issued a statement celebrating her, quote, unmistakable voice and unique style. Isabella Gomez Sarmiento, NPR News.
And I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News, from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from USPS. USPS Ground Advantage Service keeps customers in the know when their shipment leaves the dock, when it's on the move, and when it's delivered. Learn more at usps.com/in-the-know. This is NPR.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C.
Amy Martinez in Culver City, California. Coming up, we'll have reporting on the Delta Airlines plane crash at the Toronto Pearson Airport. But first,
today in Saudi Arabia, U.S. and Russian diplomats met to discuss ways to end Russia's war in Ukraine. After the meeting, which was billed as peace talks, the U.S. delegation led by Secretary of State Marco Rubio addressed reporters.
We agreed on what the goal is. The goal is to bring an end to this conflict in a way that's fair, enduring, sustainable, and acceptable to all parties involved.
Joining us to talk about what was achieved and what wasn't is NPR's Russia correspondent Charles Maines. Good morning, Charles.
Hi there.
Okay, so this meeting just wrapped up. What can you tell us?
Well, the meeting was a direct result of that phone call last week between President Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin, during which these two leaders agreed to pursue this negotiated end to the war in Ukraine. Secretary of State Marco Rubio, as we heard, headed the U.S. delegation along with White House envoy Steve Witkoff, National Security Advisor Mike Waltz as well, who said that they showed up determined to get things done.
President Trump is determined to move very quickly. We just had a head of state phone call, the first in years, and here we are less than a week later at the highest level of the U.S. and Russian government, and we expect to continue to drive that pace.
Now, these talks paced out at about 4.5 hours. Both sides described them as positive, as serious. They also made clear this was just an initial step towards more negotiations to end the war. They didn't expect to solve it in one day.
But Charles, notably, Ukrainian and European officials were absent today. Did either side address that?
Yeah, no, that's right. You know, Ukraine was not even invited, although both Trump and the Kremlin say Ukraine will be involved in some way at some point. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has warned Kyiv won't recognize any deals that are done without Ukraine. And Europe, of course, has been upset about being sidelined, an issue they see as key to European security. Yet the American delegation, Waltz in particular, pushed back against this idea that somehow Kyiv or Europe was being ignored. He said, no, this was just shuttle diplomacy. You talk to different sides and pass on what they have to say.
Now, given the atmosphere you describe, are we witnessing something more here? Is this a reset between the U.S. and Russia?
Well, it certainly feels like it's headed that direction. You know, both sides say they would move forward with plans for a meeting between Trump and Putin. They've now agreed to meet face-to-face. So by all accounts, Russia's isolation over its actions in Ukraine appear over. In fact, after the talks, Lavrov spoke about how it wasn't normal for big countries like the U.S. and Russia to not engage as they hadn't during the Biden years. But things were different now.
Я считаю, очень полезный.
So here he says that the talks were useful, and for the first time in a long time, Russia felt not just heard, but listened to.
Okay, following these talks, do we have any sense of what the outlines of a deal might look like?
Well, President Trump has said Ukraine must give up both its NATO ambitions and territory to Moscow. These are two key Russian demands that have really fed fears that Ukraine won't have a say in its own future. But Secretary of State Rubio, as we heard in that intro, says he wants a deal acceptable to all parties. How that works, where borders are drawn, I don't think anybody knows, including Rubio. But there's clearly a concern in Ukraine that while Kyiv wants a just peace, Trump just wants peace. And because of that, and because Moscow has the upper hand both on the battlefield and around the negotiating table, they're nervous.
NPR's Russia correspondent Charles Maines, thank you for your reporting.
Thank you.
The White House argues that the unit known as a Department of Government Efficiency needs access to an IRS database that contains the financial records of millions of Americans. DOGE says it's part of their plan to combat waste, fraud, and abuse in the government. Critics say, though, giving a political appointee, such as Elon Musk, access to such highly sensitive data raises serious concerns about privacy and potential misuse. Let's ask Nina Olson about this. She served for almost two decades as the National Taxpayer Advocate inside the IRS and is now the Executive Director of the Center for Taxpayer Rights. So, Nina, what's in there in that IRS database that could help DOGE identify, as they say, waste, fraud, and abuse? What's obvious in there?
Well, the IDRS system, the Integrated Data Retrieval System, is basically a way for IRS employees to access pretty much all of the information that the IRS has, whether it's criminal investigation information, taxpayer returns, taxpayer accounts, just every single database. And so I suppose if you're trying to identify fraud, waste, and abuse, you could dump all of that into some AI system that who knows what it's been trained on, and then declare that you've identified all sorts of returns that have problems. The problem is we don't know what the use is that they're proposing, and access to that database, to that system, IDRS, is closely controlled, and IRS employees are only allowed to access those components that relate directly to their job duties. And if you try to access something else, then that's essentially a crime, unless it was just inadvertent, like you typed in Social Security number and you switch digits or something like that by mistake.
Would someone from DOGE, or maybe someone that's maybe not, you know, intimately aware of IRS information and language, be able to say, oh, that's waste and that's fraud?
Well, that's the problem. I mean, you know, do these folks have background in tax law? You know, we have a very complex code, and you know, the people that are actually making the determinations are the delegated authority to decide that something is an error or is incorrect or is on the fraud side, which is very rare. You know, fraud is very rare. It's hard to prove. And the government bears the burden of proof on fraud. You have to have training on that. And so if you're just a software engineer, it's, you know, you don't have the background to say it's fraud. You can say this is looking very unusual, but someone else has to make that determination.
So there is no guarantee, as far as you're aware, Nina, that if, say, DOGE were to find fraud and just say so, that we would be given that evidence, like all of us, for us to see it too?
Well, in order to take an action against a taxpayer, taxpayers have rights. You know, they have due process. So the IRS has to conduct an audit. It has to provide information to the taxpayer, notice to the taxpayer, give them an opportunity to protest. It has to, in most instances, send them something called a notice of deficiency after it feels like there's some error or fraud. And then you are able to go to the tax court to protest that and prove that you do not have an error or in the instance of fraud, and we're using fraud very loosely. Yeah. You know, fraud is a very specific thing, and there are certain elements that the government has to prove, which, as I say, is very, very hard. And you also have the right to present evidence to counter that. So it's not like you can just make a declaration and then have any impact with that against individual taxpayers or businesses.
Now, the IRS is in the middle of a big push to modernize its outdated technology. So knowing that, could Elon Musk's team be helpful in that effort? And do they need access to that database to actually do that?
Yes, well, the IRS has been trying for a long time to modernize its technology, and everyone agrees that it needs to. And so with funding from the Inflation Reduction Act, it's made great progress. Its own inspector general has said as much back in last fall. And the IRS has lots of contractors working, well, not lots, but has contractors working on its system. And the law allows that they can have access to tax returns and tax return information to the extent necessary and for the purposes of reprogramming, et cetera. But you can do a lot of that work without actual taxpayer data seeing people's names, identity, et cetera. You can use dummy data. You can use anonymized data to test the systems. And only until the very end, maybe, would you need to do a full run with actual taxpayer data. And the question is, well, who needs to do that?
Nina Olson is the executive director of the Center for Taxpayer Rights. Nina, thanks.
Thank you.
An investigation is underway to understand how a Delta Airlines flight ended up upside down on a runway at Toronto's Pearson International Airport. 17 people were injured, at least two critically, on Monday after the commuter plane arriving from Minneapolis crash-landed and flipped over on the tarmac. All 80 people on board, passengers and crew, survived. NPR's Jackie Northam reports.
It was shortly after 2 p.m. when Delta Airlines Flight 4819 was coming in for landing at Toronto Pearson International Airport. Winds were gusting about 40 miles an hour, and there had been heavy snowfall in the area for the past 3 weeks. The CRJ-900 commuter jet crashed on landing, flipped over, and lay belly up on the snowy tarmac. Its right wing sheared off.
Drop it! Come on!
A video posted on social media by passenger Pete Kukoff showed crew trying to help people quickly off the plane. Another passenger, John Nelson, describes the scene outside.
Our plane crashed. It's upside down. Fire department's on site.
Emergency crews worked to put out a fire and take the injured for help.
Airport emergency workers mounted a textbook response, reaching the site within minutes and quickly evacuating the passengers.
Deborah Flint is president and CEO of Pearson Airport. During a press conference, she said there were no fatalities in the crash and that some of the passengers have been reunited with family and friends.
We do expect that there will be some operational impact and some delays at the airport over the next few days while the two runways remain closed for the investigation.
Since the flight took off from Minneapolis, National Transportation Safety Boards in the U.S. and Canada will work together to determine the cause of the crash. The Canadian crash comes less than a month after a mid-air collision between an American Airlines jet and a U.S. military helicopter killed 67 people at Washington, D.C.'s Reagan National Airport. Jackie Northam, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Thank you. On the next Fresh Air, 25 years ago, measles was declared eliminated in the United States. Today, measles is back, and infectious disease specialist Dr. Adam Ratner has written a new book that makes the case that the resurgence is a warning of an uncertain future for children's health. His book is called Booster Shots. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from EBSCO, committed to making it easy for people to discover and access library resources anytime from anywhere with bibliograph and linked data technology. Learn more at EBSCO.com. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org. From the estate of Jane Gross, whose bequest supports NPR's commitment to creating a more informed public by distributing programming that meets the highest standards of public service and journalism. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people at wtgrantfdn.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Martinez.
And I'm Leila Fadel. New York Governor Kathy Hochul says she may use her authority to force New York City Mayor Eric Adams from office.
That announcement came after four of Adams' most trusted aides, including the city's first deputy mayor, announced yesterday they're quitting. Turmoil in New York escalated after the U.S. Department of Justice dropped corruption charges against Adams. And critics say that move was part of the deal to secure Adams' help with President Trump's deportation policies.
NPR's Brian Mann has been following all of this and joins me now. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Leila.
So what did Governor Hochul say?
Well, in a statement, Hochul said she spoke with Deputy Mayor Maria Torres Springer, one of Adams' top aides who's resigning. And that conversation left Hochul with, and I'm quoting here, serious questions about the long-term future of this mayoral administration. Hochul acknowledged no governor in the last 235 years has used their authority to oust an elected mayor of New York City. But Hochul then pointed to the crisis in City Hall, which she said is troubling and cannot be ignored. So Hochul now says she'll meet with key leaders in Manhattan later today for what she describes as a conversation about the path forward.
Now, four top Adams aides are quitting. How big a deal is that?
Yeah, it's huge. It's a wipeout of Mayor Adams' top leadership, and this clearly got Hochul's attention. New York City is a complicated place to govern under the best of circumstances, and those departing hold key roles, dealing with everything from the city's infrastructure to the ongoing challenges from migrants arriving in the city. These were really the people keeping things on track. While Adams faced those DOJ criminal charges, now they're headed out the door. It's important to remember, too, Leila, this isn't the first wave of departures. Other key city leaders have also gone.
Yeah, I mean, and this case has been mired in controversy, Brian. We saw a slew of resignations at the Department of Justice over its decision to drop the charges against Mayor Eric Adams. Just remind us what Adams was accused of and why the DOJ suspended the case.
Yeah, in September, the DOJ laid out a sweeping case against Adams, alleging he used the power of various city offices over nearly a decade to solicit lavish vacations and improper campaign contributions. Some of the bribes allegedly came from foreign agents working for Turkey. Adams has denied any wrongdoing and said the charges were political retribution for his criticism of the Biden administration's immigration policies. He never offered any evidence to support those claims. This month, the DOJ moved to shelve this case, saying a criminal trial would prevent Adams from helping the Trump administration deal with migrants in the city who don't have legal status. As you say, that decision by the Justice Department was so controversial, at least seven top federal attorneys have resigned.
Any sign that Adams plans to step down?
You know, he's facing intense pressure to go. Hochul's statement and these latest resignations raise the temperature even more. But speaking on Sunday at a Baptist church, the mayor was defiant.
And I want you to be clear. Come on. You're going to hear so many rumors and so many things. You're going to read so much. I am going nowhere. Nowhere.
And in a statement Leila sent to NPR, Adams said he's disappointed by these latest departures, but the city will keep functioning. The situation, of course, moving very quickly. We'll see what moves Governor Hochul makes later today.
NPR's Brian Mann following developments in New York City. I'm sure we'll have you back on soon. Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
In Pakistan, journalists are concerned about a change to the country's cybercrimes law they say will stifle free speech. The government says the measure will help curb the spread of disinformation. Now, the law has triggered protests from journalists around the country. Betsy Joles reports from Lahore.
Outside the Lahore Press Club, around 50 journalists are chanting about the fight for press freedom. TV journalist Arsalan Rafiq Bhatti says they're trying to get the government's attention.
They can't stop us from speaking the truth, from highlighting the problems of the people.
They're protesting amendments passed last month that criminalize what the government deems as the act of spreading disinformation online. Penalties include a prison sentence of up to 3 years or a fine of as much as $7,000. The measures also create new bodies to regulate content and investigate people who share it. Officials say the law is necessary to curb the intentional sharing of information that creates unrest in society. But Sher Ali Khalti, Joint Secretary of the Punjab Union of Journalists, says these rules may instead be used to block out criticism.
They say that we are against fake news, but who will define the fake news?
Pakistan has a history of media censorship, and rights groups say even before these changes, the law was being used to target journalists. Now the definition of unlawful content includes false information that damages the reputation of members of the judiciary, legislature, and armed forces. Khalti says these regulations could make it dangerous to report on issues deemed sensitive by the state.
After this enactment, I think we can't do journalism.
This law doesn't just apply to journalists, but extends to every Pakistani on the internet.
Due to the lack of digital literacy in this country, people absolutely have no idea the consequences of such a law.
This is Nika Dad, the founder of the Digital Rights Foundation. She says people can also be reported and punished for sharing what the government considers false information on social media, including WhatsApp. She says that makes it all the more important for them to be careful with what they share.
Before forwarding any content or resharing any content, just verify it whether this is true or not.
The new regulations are already being challenged in several courts. Journalists say they're prepared to continue protesting until the law is repealed. For NPR News, I'm Betsy Joles in Lahore, Pakistan.
Tomorrow on Morning Edition, we speak with three reporters following the impacts of President Trump's immigration enforcement actions across the country. Tune in on your phone or with your smart speaker by asking for your NPR station by name. This is NPR News.
A Syrian soccer player became the voice of the country's revolution with his iconic protest anthems. He was killed in 2019, but the man who wrote his songs still lives. I'm Elsa Chang, the singer and the songwriter who scored a revolution. That story on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Secretary of State Marco Rubio says the U.S. and Moscow have agreed to begin working on negotiations to end Russia's war in Ukraine. Speaking in Riyadh today, following several hours of talks with a Russian delegation, Rubio said ending the war will require concessions on all sides. Russia's foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, led the delegation from Moscow. No officials from Kyiv were at the talks. Rubio says no date has been set for a summit between President Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin. Kentucky's governor says a lot of people in his state are hurting in the aftermath of deadly flooding. At least 12 people were killed after more than a half foot of rain triggered the floods. The damage is widespread, says Governor Andy Beshear.
I was in Pike County yesterday, seeing homes and businesses that have just been destroyed, several feet of mud, everything inside just wiped away. Folks that didn't have a lot to begin with, losing what they had.
He was speaking to NPR's Morning Edition. Extreme cold in the central U.S. now extends from Montana and the Dakotas to Oklahoma and Texas. Temperatures are well below zero this morning in many northern states. This is NPR News from Washington. The Trump administration's efforts to downsize government include federal health agencies. More than 1,000 employees have received termination letters at the Food and Drug Administration, the National Institutes of Health, and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The Department of Energy is rescinding the firings of many workers responsible for overseeing the nation's nuclear weapons. As NPR's Jeff Brumfield reports, the reversal came within hours of mass terminations.
Over the weekend, several employees at the National Nuclear Security Administration told NPR they've been hastily rehired after being fired last Thursday. Sources inside the agency said hundreds were fired at first, but in a statement sent late Sunday night, a Department of Energy spokesperson said that fewer than 50 employees ultimately lost their jobs. Those jobs were in, quote, primarily administrative and clerical roles. Members of Congress were alarmed after learning of the mass layoffs at the agency, which oversees America's nuclear warheads and combats nuclear terrorism. Jeff Brumfield, NPR News, Washington.
A federal judge has scheduled a court hearing tomorrow to hear why the Justice Department wants corruption charges dropped against New York Mayor Eric Adams. Several prosecutors in Washington and New York who disagree with the recommendation have since resigned. Adams says he will not step down. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From Hiscox, committed to helping small businesses protect their dreams. Quotes and information on customized insurance for specific risks are available at Hiscox.com. Hiscox, business insurance experts. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez in Culver City, California.
And I'm Leila Fadel in Washington. The Trump administration has begun making broad cuts to federal health agencies.
Yeah, more than 1,000 employees got letters terminating their employment at the Food and Drug Administration, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and the National Institutes of Health.
NPR's Ping Wong joins us now to discuss. Good morning, Ping.
Good morning, Leila.
So what will staffers of these agencies find as they get back to work from the 3-day weekend?
You know, they're not really clear. They're going back to the office today, and they don't really know who to expect or who they're going to see. Mm. That's because over the weekend, around 1,000 people got fired from NIH, around 750 from CDC. Some people are also let go from FDA, though we're not sure how many at this point. And I do want to note that those numbers are quite a bit lower than what was expected. We heard some people that told us that they had been told on Friday they were going to lose their jobs but haven't gotten a letter yet. And we heard that some of those jobs were saved at the last minute because they were considered essential, but people in leadership say they're really not clear what the criteria was.
Do we know who was cut?
So we know some were people that were working to ensure medical devices are safe at FDA. Others were diagnosing the causes of outbreaks at CDC, and there were many, many others. What they seem to have in common was that they were mostly probationary employees, so people who are new to the agency or just moved to a different job. They were serving a one or two year trial period, and they have fewer worker protections. He spoke with Steve Monroe, a senior official who retired from CDC in 2021. He says it seems short-sighted to just axe the people that are easier to fire.
Regardless of whether they were filling an important role in the organization or how they were performing in that role, we're just going to fire everybody who's been here for less than a year.
He says it's also bad for development and for morale.
Well, on that point of performance, how much do we know about why they were fired?
Well, the letters that they received, and we've seen a few of them, they're all very similar. They came from the Department of Health and Human Services, which is the agency that oversees all the health agencies, now led by Robert F. Kennedy Jr. And the letters do say, quote, you are not fit for continued employment with the agency, and, quote, your performance has not been adequate. It ends their employment on March 14th and says they're going to be put on administrative leave until then. But we know for a fact that many of the people who got this letter had recently received stellar performance reviews. Reviews from their workplace. One from CDC had recently received an award of excellence for their work preventing animals with infectious diseases like rabies from entering the country. It's not clear why these employees were told their performance was inadequate, but many have responded with documentation of their high performance.
So where does this lead the agencies?
Well, it's been a really confusing and chaotic time. Workers say that they feel demoralized, vilified, characterized as lazy by some in the Trump administration when they and their colleagues say that they work really hard to serve and protect the public. And they see this as just the first wave. They're expecting more cuts, deeper restructuring to come. Even workers with full protections think they could be next. You know, they've been canceling their Netflix accounts, reducing retirement contributions to save a little money in case they find themselves fired too.
NPR's Ping Wong. Thank you, Ping.
You're welcome.
Americans all over the country are feeling the effects of the Trump administration's actions in Washington, including President Trump's blanket freeze on federal funds, which still persists in some places despite judges' orders to release the money. NPR's Andrea Hsu has a story of an entrepreneur in California who's found himself in the middle of the freeze.
It took a leap of faith for Ryan Dowdy to launch his small business last year. But the food scientist had a product he truly believed in, Ready Bar.
Ready Bar is an intermediate moisture food and it's shelf stable for up to 2 years.
If that sounds like something astronauts would eat, that's because it is. Dowdy used to work for NASA, managing the food on the International Space Station. He was a guy making food in pouches, like chili and grits, also freeze-dried food.
Which people are familiar with in terms of the freeze-dried ice cream, even though, trust me, we never sent that to to the International Space Station.
He also worked on what's called intermediate moisture foods, things soft enough to bite into, but not so moist that bacteria can grow. It was that technology that Dowdy kept thinking about after he left Houston and moved to California to be closer to family. He realized that there are people on Earth who could use foods like that. First responders who face high-stress environments just like astronauts.
They tend to have similar nutritional requirements in terms of a lack of time to sit down and have a meal when they're in the field.
They need something convenient they can keep in a go bag. Also,
something that doesn't give you a sugar crash.
Like so many other products on the market. Last year, he started making Ready Bars with that NASA technology, and he was thrilled to learn in January that he'd won a small business innovation grant from the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
I was going to ensure that our high-performance meal bars maintained their flavor, their texture, and their nutritional integrity over the 2-year shelf life.
Dowdy was expecting additional paperwork to finalize the award and a press release to announce the grantees. That kind of publicity can be invaluable for attracting other investors. Instead, 2 weeks after winning the grant, something else was announced. President Trump's blanket freeze on government grants. The administration said it needed time to review them to ensure they don't conflict with any of the president's executive orders or his policies. Dowdy was actually on the phone with a potential investor that day who asked if he thought his USDA grant might be frozen.
And I said, no way. We're an American small business. We're fueling first responders for emergency situations. This is something that is so across the aisle, everybody can get behind us. There's no way that this funding is frozen.
Turns out he was wrong. The next day, his contact at USDA confirmed it.
And that was really frustrating.
The point of the government grants is to support projects that can lead to significant public benefits. Dowdy says that's what he's doing. He was counting on the USDA grant to get him through what he calls the valley of death, the gap between having a creative idea and bringing it to market. This year, he was going to bring on a research technician, his first employee. But now...
100% I'm worried that I may never see this funding.
Which would be a real setback. The USDA grants are highly competitive and highly desirable.
Because they're so good for small businesses.
The government doesn't ask for a piece of ownership like investors do. The grants don't need to be paid back.
It's just about funding good science that solves problems to feed people better.
Dowdy hopes that continues to be a priority under the Trump administration. The Department of Agriculture told NPR they'll provide more information once the new agriculture secretary can analyze the grant reviews. Brooke Rollins was just sworn in last week. Andrea Hsu, NPR News.
Later today on All Things Considered, how the Trump administration's funding freeze is impacting efforts to fight AIDS around the world. Tune in on your phone with the NPR app or on your reliable radio through your local NPR station. This is NPR News.
Firefighters and experts in Los Angeles are worried about the next catastrophic wildfire as the Trump administration freezes funding. Next time on Here and Now.
The latest in national politics, inspiring podcasts, and a report from your local school board meeting last week. You can hear it all in one place with the NPR app. Download it today.
Good morning, I'm Leila Falde. Norwegian fishers are on the lookout for nearly 30,000 salmon on the run. Seafood company Maui said it discovered damage to a pen during a storm earlier this month. Maui is offering 500 kroner, about $45 per salmon, to get them back. It's not just about catching the fish to turn around and sell them. Farm salmon can be a big threat to salmon in the wild. The escapees weigh about 160 tons in total. Fine kettle of fish indeed. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their client's best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil psyllium fiber supplements to support daily digestive health by trapping and removing waste. Learn more at metamucil.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Leila Fadel. Mexico is mourning the loss of one of its most beloved singers, Paquita La del Barrio. NPR's Ada Peralta has this remembrance of an artist known for excoriating men as she sang about heartbreak.
Paquita La del Barrio's most famous song is epic for its contempt. A rat with two legs, it's called, and in it she calls her lover a snake, a spawn from hell, and scum of the earth.
Rata inmunda, animal rastrero, escoria de la vida.
It's a litany of insults written in exquisite Spanish. You rat, I'm talking to you, she sings, because even a bottom-feeding maggot is better than you.
Rata de dos.
Paquita was born Francisca Viveros Barradas, poor, the child of an affair, to a single mother who had bad luck with men. And Paquita couldn't escape the same fate. She dropped out of school in the sixth grade. At 17, she fell in love with a man in his 40s. She was pregnant by 18, and then she found out he was married. In an interview on Imagen TV, she said it caused terrible suffering.
Pero se le cerraron el mundo, y ya con hijos, peor.
But what can you do, she said. Your world closes, and with kids, it's so much worse. Paquita remarried, but after 3 decades, she found out her husband was cheating. She left him, but just before his death, she forgave him.
El hombre este es tan bruto que causa lástima.
Men are so stupid, she said. You have to pity them. Her songs were just as direct, and they struck a nerve. She recorded more than 30 albums, which sold more than 30 million copies.
No me vengas con el cuento, que eres todo un caballero.
Piérdeme el respeto, she sings. Don't tell me you're a gentleman. Instead, lose respect for me and make me your most unseemly proposition.
Piérdeme el respeto. Déjate de cosas.
Graciela Roque, who runs the feminist website La Cadera de Eva, says Paquita La del Barrio liberated Mexican women. For decades, they were told men are men and women should suffer in silence. Paquita taught them.
You can suffer in a different way. Like, you can suffer in a mean way and in a trashy way, and it's fine.
In her music, Paquita shamed a cheater for being bad at sex. She sang about getting revenge by cheating herself. But she also bared the deepest of pain.
She was not afraid to show us, like, the full complexity of those emotions.
My friends ask me why I like to drink, she sang. It's because this ungrateful life has only given me sorrow.
La vida, la ingrata vida, me ha dado solo tristeza. Yo nací para sufrir.
Paquita La del Barrio died at her home. She was 77 years old. Ada Peralta, NPR News, Mexico City.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm A. Martinez.
We'll be right back.
How much of our tax and Social Security records should Team Elon Musk get to see?
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Viking, exploring the world in comfort. With a fleet of small ships, Viking offers travel experiences for the thinking person. Discover more at Viking.com.
I'm David Brancaccio. As you've been hearing, the Trump administration is defending giving the Elon Musk-led advisory group access to the detailed tax records of all Americans. Presidential advisor Stephen Miller says it is about rooting out foreign fraud. And now this DOGE advisory group is reportedly trying to get access to Social Security records. Here's Marketplace's Nova Safo.
The Social Security Administration holds a treasure trove of data on Americans, says Nancy Altman, president of the nonprofit Social Security Works.
It's records. It's who gets what benefits and when they get paid and the dates they're due and who their dependent benefits are and what their children are getting and what their survivors will get and so forth.
Altman says there's no reason for Musk's DOGE group to have access to this data. The administration's acting commissioner, Michelle King, reportedly resigned over the weekend rather than grant that access. Meanwhile, White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt told Fox News that DOGE is looking for fraud.
They haven't dug into the books yet, but they suspect that there are tens of millions of deceased people who are receiving fraudulent Social Security payments.
But Social Security auditors had already uncovered millions of outdated listings on the administration's database. That doesn't mean those people were getting payments. Auditors found improper payments made up less than 1% of what Social Security sent to Americans. I'm Nova Safwa for Marketplace.
And the White House, in a filing, said Elon Musk is not the head of DOGE, that outfit looking for government waste, nor is he a decider there, according to an official document spotted by the publication Axios. Special government. Check also to 10th percent, the S&P 500, little changed. An index of the confidence of home builders out today fell to its lowest in 5 months. Fears of tariffs for building materials and persistently high mortgage rates are part of this. Now to the Marketplace Economic Pulse. Checkups from a range of perspectives. With 16,000 structures burned in Southern California, what happens to jobs longer term? Middlebury College professor Raphael Gauvin-Coulomb is co-author of a piece that looks into this. It's in the Journal of Environmental Economics and Management. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So clearly, disruption in the near term, that almost is obvious, right?
Yes, and we do find effects that last about 3 years after the fires. And we do find that an increase in fire exposure leads to a decline in employment growth that can last for about 3 years after the fire.
And it's not that the business burnt down and couldn't hire, it's you think it has to do with flows of potential labor.
So part of it is evidence of a shrinking labor force, because we see evidence that some people decide to migrate. But of course, we can imagine that some businesses are also demanding less workers in response to fires, especially in industries like services and tourism.
But Professor, what about federal disaster aid when FEMA comes in? I mean, that's been shown in other disasters to be perversely a kind of economic positive with all the rebuilding.
And that's exactly right. So if we look only at fires that receive a FEMA disaster declaration, which is a small portion of fires. And here it's important to note that a FEMA disaster declaration is a precondition for a wide range of federal assistance program. So when we look at only the fires that got this disaster declaration, then we do not see any negative economic effects of fires.
In other words, the federal money mutes the economic impact, and in fact, you don't see job creation go down.
Exactly. It's able to offset the effect on both employment and migration.
All right. Now, for communities that don't get a disaster declaration, and for many fires and sometimes other disasters, you don't get one, are there lessons for local communities, counties, states in your data about how to somehow compensate for the possibility that people will leave and that therefore jobs will leave?
That's a difficult question. What we do find is that some communities tend to be more robust, even if they don't receive financial aid. And that's because some communities are more diversified economically or have a more educated workforce. So we find that these communities are much more resilient against the economic effects of fires.
Taking today's economic pulse, economist Raphael Govan-Coulombe is an assistant professor of economics at Middlebury College. Some of this was published in the Journal of Environmental Economics and Management. Professor, thank you.
Thank you.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Amazon Business, focused on offering smart business buying solutions, leading time to focus on growth. More at AmazonBusiness.com. And by Schwab. Schwab offers investors choices like full-service wealth management, self-directed investing options, and trading on thinkorswim. More at Schwab.com.
Sales of new cars and trucks dropped by a whopping 25% in January from December, according to Cox Automotive. I mean, January can be a post-holiday lull, plus the weather and wildfires. Inventory sitting on dealer lots are up 14% compared to a year ago, which for car shoppers spell opportunity. Here's Marketplace's.
Dealerships were pretty barren for a while after COVID shutdowns and chip shortages messed up car manufacturing, but slowly and steadily, lots have filled back up.
Higher inventory levels on dealer lots are really good for the buyers.
Sam Fiorani is with Auto Forecast Solutions.
If you have more to choose from, the dealers want to get them off the lot, and so they will negotiate.
And they might throw in a lower interest rate loan or a rebate. And yet, average new car prices are still up there, 2.5% higher than a year ago. Aaron Keating at Cox Automotive says that's largely because of the kinds of vehicles carmakers have been building and drivers have been buying.
In America, we really like our vehicles large. We like them to come with all the bells and whistles, and we want every variety in between.
Providing all those options is costly, so carmakers charge more, and they're unlikely to bring prices down anytime soon, she says, especially if they're hurt by more tariffs from the Trump administration. I'm Henry Epp for Marketplace.
And I'm Dave Baccio with Marketplace Morning Report. From AP, American Public Media.
My lovely Elizabeth.
Deeply worried at heart. I say I'm deeply worried at heart. 'Cause the girl I love so well, my friend has emerged from me. Now I scarcely know what to do but to hang my head and cry for my lovely Isabel. People say there are many guys that are really crazy after me, but I'm not interested in any.